Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Mickey Huff, director of Project Censored, and Nolan Higdon about their new book, Let's Agree to Disagree, A Critical Thinking Guide to Communication, Conflict Management, and Critical Media Literacy. And you can learn more at Project Censored, one word, projectcensored.org. On Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, at my site, and at most major podcast sites. My site is TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. It's been a few years since I've featured Project Censored on Free Forum, though for a while I did so regularly, talking with Peter Phillips, who assumed directorship in 1996 from the founder Carl Jensen. And Philip served till one of today's guests, Mickey Huff, succeeded him in 2010. And I spoke with Phillips. I went back and looked at the records. I spoke with him in 2002, 2005, 2006, 2008. And I went back and looked at those interviews. And in 2005, as far back as 2005, I mentioned that Project Censored was at that point over 25 years old. So add 18 years, and it's now at least 43, well into middle age. You may notice also that those years that I was speaking pretty regularly with Pete Phillips were all during the administration of George W. Bush. And while many have normalized Bush as a never-Trumper and an erstwhile amateur painter, let us not forget that though he didn't lie with the volume and the relentlessness of Trump, his Dick Cheney-inspired lying led us to invade Iraq, likely causing more damage and loss of life than Trump has wreaked so far. On this show, in fact, I spoke with Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity, who wrote the book 935 Lies, citing the number of falsehoods in the run-up to the Iraq War. Now, I asked myself why I hadn't spoken with Project Censored in the intervening years, and well, some of it is just circumstance. You know, things rise to front of mind, things fall, and we go on. But I suspect it also had to do with the proliferation of online sources and online information. The problem may have seemed to shift from stories not being covered to everything being covered, including a lot that wasn't true. It struck me that if Project Censored, an organization called Project Censored, had been created in the last few years, it would likely be a bastion of anti-vaxxers, peddlers of the big lie about the 2020 election, and conspiracy theorists, if not full-on QAnon. So what is the role of Project Censored in 2023? And what are Huff and Higdon dealing with in Let's Agree to Disagree? Here are the new book's very first lines. In an age defined by divisive discourse and disinformation, democracy hangs in the balance. Let's Agree to Disagree seeks to reverse these trends by fostering constructive dialogue through critical thinking and critical media literacy. Okay. Mickey Huff is the director of Project Censored and president of the nonprofit Media Freedom Foundation. He's co-edited 14 editions of the project's yearbook, including most recently Project Censored State of the Free Press 2023 with Andy Lee Roth. He's a professor of social science, history, and journalism at Diablo Valley College, where he co-chairs the history program and is chair of the journalism department. Huff is executive producer and host of the weekly Project Censored show that airs across the U.S. on Pacifica Radio. Nolan Higdon, a lecturer at Merrill College in the education department at University of California, Santa Cruz, is a founding member of the Critical Media Literacy Conference of the Americas and a longtime contributor to Project Censored. His books include The Anatomy of Fake News and The Podcaster's Dilemma, Decolonizing Podcasters in the Era of Surveillance Capitalism. And Huff and Higdon, as I said, are co-authors of Well, no, they are co-authors previously of United States of Distraction, Media Manipulations in Post-Truth America, and their latest, Let's Agree to Disagree, A Critical Thinking Guide to Communication, Conflict Management, and Critical Media Literacy. Welcome, Mickey Huff, bearded camera, I'm not sure, as I'm looking at it, camera right, and Nolan Higdon, Les Hirsute, and with the Let's Agree to Disagree background on camera left. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and ideas we talk about. So I'm going to ask you, Ease, to tell us a bit about your path to the work you do today. Mentors, turning points, moments of decision, and feel free to go way back. Sometimes, you know, someone will cite a childhood experience or a high school experience or their first, you know, their first press gig or something. Also, let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, April 12th. Mickey, first, your path.
So thanks, Terrence. It's an honor to be here with you. We're looking forward to the conversation. My path goes back a ways. I grew up in the 70s, went to high school in the 80s, grew up in a working class family in Western Pennsylvania. My family didn't have college background, but were very interested in the arts and reading. And I grew up with a lot of books around our house. A lot of folks in the neighborhood, when you had to do book reports and things, people would come to my house because my dad had a, you know, Encyclopedia, the World Book and Britannica, and had subscriptions to Life and Time and Newsweek. And, you know, in the 70s, early 80s, you know, it was kind of a lot to have that kind of, you know, stuff for working, you know, families. You know, a lot of the people that we grew up around didn't have access to books like that unless they were at school. So I grew up around that, and my dad really watched a lot of media news. So I grew up with a curious fascination, you know, around world events, especially living in, you know, rural Pennsylvania. It's not like I'm in some, you know, hotbed of a cosmopolitan area or something. So I grew up kind of in a quiet area, but I grew up watching things happen. And as I got older, I really started to get into music a lot. And I was really interested in, I was a professional musician for a long time, but I got into heavy metal and punk music. And the authoritarian strain in a lot of the lyrics and the connections to current events and things were really fascinating to me. And I noticed that when they talked about current events and things in song lyrics, they had a very different interpretation of what was happening than the TV, you know, or Time and Newsweek. And years later, I actually learned that, you know, one of the bands I listened to early on, the Dead Kennedys, the punk band from San Francisco, Jello Biafra, the singer, used to read the Bay Guardian newspaper that published Carl Jensen's top censored stories every year. So little did I know, I was getting early doses of Project Censored through music.
Sure.
And of course, much later in my life, when I moved to California, I tracked down Peter Phillips, the second director of the project, because I had a huge passion, and I was very much against censorship in the arts. I was very interested in media, and I was very interested in deconstructing propaganda. And so I really mentored under Peter Phillips for a long time, became associate director. And watch what you wish for, Terrence, because I asked for it, and boy, did I get it. So that's the short version, Cliff's Notes version of sort of my trajectory. But I've had an interest and a passion in media and free press issues and anti-censorship issues for a long, long time. And I think Project Censored is unfortunately more relevant now than ever. And maybe we can get into some of that later on.
Very good. Yeah. And as I say, of course it is, but the role has changed a
yes.
great deal because
it
the
has.
Environment is so, so different. Nolan, your path.
Absolutely. Yeah. I too grew up in a working class background. And was also the first to go to college in my family. I went to a grammar school where whites were actually a minority as well, which I think ended up being quite important later on in life. And I always had a passion for history and media. I would say my first media lesson was when I was 4 or 5 years old. There was some toy I wanted to buy after a commercial I saw. And my mom told me we couldn't have it. She's like, you can't believe those commercials. The toy probably really doesn't do that. It was my first lesson of like, oh, they lie. I never knew this. And then I, you know, had some great history instructor, Mr. Langley in high school, who got me really big into history, and he made us do news journal assignments to stay up to date on the news. I remember I focused a lot on what was going on in Kosovo at that time in the 90s. And then actually, this is where Mickey and I crossed paths. I was a student of Mickey's at Diablo Valley College. And this kind of fits back to where Terrence started the show today, which was this was during the run up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. So this is 2002. And Mickey was probably one of the only voices I came across in person of someone who was criticizing the media narratives. And in his class provided some historical context to how and why media lie. And I was sort of fascinated that this was not taught to me earlier, that I had to sort of randomly stumble into a random history class to get this critical lesson. And so I spent quite a lot of time, as most people in California do, lambasting conservative media until I sort of got into my 20s and recognized that, like, you know, a lot of this nonsense also goes on in liberal media as well. And I was sort of profoundly taken by how many times I'd been in debates with a conservative rightly critiquing something from conservative policy wonks, and they would shoot back, but what about this on the left, or what about that? And I kept noting how this just it stifles conversation when we're stuck in a left-right divide. And I think I was partially helped by the fact that I was born in Kentucky, and when I was a couple months old, moved out to California, but I have a ton of family in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I was always able to juxtapose those two parts of the country and how they were seeing things differently. And that was a real big source of strength for me, because I knew these weren't, you know, evil people who grew out of some, like, you know, foreign enemy or something. These were folks who had a different life experience and helped me kind of understand where they were coming from. But I also knew where I was coming from. So I think those were some of the critical factors and helped develop how we ended up at projects like Project Censor and Let's Agree to Disagree and other things Mickey and I have done together over the years.
Very good. Very good. So let's talk first about Project Censored, and I'll turn to you, Mickey. The origin story. This would go back to Carl Jensen, who I'm sure mentored Peter Phillips, and thus it goes. But yeah, how did it start, and what did it set out to do? And I would say it's fairly remarkable that it's been doing it for as long as it's been doing it.
Yeah, Terrence, we're the longest continuously existing media watchdog organization in the United States, actually. Founded in 1976 at Sonoma State University, about an hour north of San Francisco, Carl Jensen himself had a kind of a life-changing event in his late 30s, early 40s. He was in an accident and he almost died. And he was in advertising and media, you know, had a background in that. And he had this epiphany that he felt like what he was doing wasn't worth much, or he wasn't changing the world. You know, he sort of had this vision of, like, what am I doing? You know? And he really changed his whole life trajectory after that. And he went and, you know, got more degrees and became a communications and sociology person and found the comms department at Sonoma State. And after the Watergate scandal broke, Jensen, who thought himself a pretty media savvy person, he wondered that what took so long for the media to break this story open and lead to the downfall of Richard Nixon, because he went back and he saw a lot of the smaller independent alternative media, not the legacy or establishment press. And look, we're talking 72, 74. So you know this, there's no cable, there's no internet, right? There's the networks, there's a young PBS, right? And then there's major newspapers and magazines. And so,
and there is when we're placing in that time frame, mm-hmm. there is at that point a thriving alternative press.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what Carl started to look at, right? And so Carl got inspired by this question of, like, what would happen if the Post and others, Washington Post, they could really get on that story earlier? Or why were they on it when they were, and not when the alternative or independent press happened to be? And what would the outcome have been? Would Nixon have won in 72?
Let me cut in for 1 second, Mickey, yeah. Just to go back on my personal path.
Yeah.
Because that in 1972, I was on the, I worked in some primaries and then was on the national staff of the McGovern campaign.
Uh-huh.
I was 24 at the time. And they sent me to run an assembly district, the most conservative assembly district in Los Angeles County. Back then, it's now very diverse. At that point, it was white labor, and labor at that point was very pro Humphrey. So, you know, and so on. But I used to talk about Watergate when I would speak as the campaign chairman in this district. I would always bring up Watergate. And my point was sort of, we're 4 years from the 200th anniversary of America, and they are trying to, you know, with Watergate and dirty tricks and so on, they are not in favor of democracy. And yet I would look and see that the national campaign never dealt with any of that. Go back.
No, and that's, I really appreciate that story. As an historian, I really appreciate that story, Terrence, because that's the kind of thing that animated Jensen. And he said, well, what else are they missing? A simple question, but a really open-ended one. And he figured the best way that we could sort of counter this kind of a problem of stories being missed is to teach people how to be more news media literate. Now, critical media literacy wasn't a term then, but he started a classroom project called Project Censored. It was a class where you would go out and the students would look at all the alternative independent media, the hard copy. This is hard copy. He subscribed to hundreds of these things. And the students would go through them and they would look for important stories. And then they would have to go and see, what did the New York Times say? Did the TV cover this? You know, et cetera. And thus began this research project to help students understand that important stories are published all the time. They just don't get the platform. And what would our society look like if we had a better, more responsible and inclusive free press and Fourth Estate? And that's the genesis of the project. So he took it further because editors and newspaper folks at the time thought his criticism was a little unfair. And they said, well, look, we only have so many column inches and so much time to do the news. So this isn't censorship. This is news judgment. And Jensen said, you know, that's a fair statement. So what Carl did is he started looking at what the news media were covering. And he realized by the early 80s that they were covering a bunch of sensationalist, trivial, kind of titillating junk that he called junk food news. He coined that term in the early 80s. And so he said, look, my critique of the media is unfortunately all too important, because not only do you fail to cover these important stories, you then say that you can't do it because you lack the resources, but you're wasting your resources on junk. And so thus was born the category of junk food news.
Let me cut in really quickly and just say that the book title that is ringing in my head right now, and in case we weren't going to mention it, I'm going to now so people can look it up, is Amusing Ourselves to Death,
Neil Postman. Yep. Absolutely brilliant book. You know, right around this time, 76 is the starting of Project Censored. 82 is Ben Bagdikian's Media Monopoly on the Problem of Media Consolidation. Postman is 84, 85. Ed Herman, Noam Chomsky is Manufacturing Consent. I mean, this is a really important era for media analysis and the beginnings of critical media literacy as an analytical field of study to look at what's going on behind the news and look at the problems. And unfortunately, Terrence, those books, those studies, and those filter, those models, the propaganda model, they are just as relevant today. They've just expanded.
Very good. Very good. So Project Censored gets set up, and then it finds a publisher and it begins to publish every year? Is it sort of more like every year and a half?
Nope. Every year. We've been working with the first book was with another publisher in Shelburne, but ever since the second book in 94-5, it was working with Dan Simon and the beginning of Seven Stories Press. So Project Censored is one of the original Seven Stories Press out of New York, whom we're now partnered with at the Censored Press. We now have our own imprint that we're partnered with Seven Stories Press, but we do the book every year. It's different every year, but what we've cataloged over time are the patterns of the kind of censorship and underreporting, the kinds of stories that are more likely to be underreported. We go over the methods by which stories are framed or underreported. We deconstruct propaganda. We call out junk news, and we highlight media democracy in action, meaning we highlight organizations and individuals that are doing great free press work. And we, again, it's not that this work isn't being done. It's that the corporate media don't really talk about it or pick up those stories. And so in a lot of ways, what we do at Project Censored is we try to replatform a lot of great work that's already been done while we also offer media criticism and analysis in our annual books, our weekly radio show, our documentary films. So we've expanded quite a bit over the years.
Right. No, it's good that people know that if you pick up the book, and I held it up and showed this is the latest version. There we are. I think probably all have one. that it's not just the stories, which is good, but it's also some background on how to deal with this, how to make yourself a better, more knowledgeable, more critical consumer and activist of information. So I looked at some of the I want just to touch on some of the stories, because as I said, there's been a shift here, because now everything is covered. If you know, this is the critical preamble, right? If you know what you're looking for, you can find it. But if you don't know what you're looking for, it won't necessarily find you.
That's
it
right.
You'll be lost in this thing. And as we know, and you folks write about, and I think we mentioned surveillance capitalism. If we didn't, you know, surveillance capitalism is that notion that if a product online is free, an information product, then you are the product. And that what it's all set up to do is to get your data. And what that world does, the other half of what that world does with its algorithms, and you guys will talk about this more, but I'm just going to put it out there quickly, is it begins to find what you are attracted to, what you're attracted to for the longest amount of time, what keeps your eyeballs there, and it begins to feed you. It's a feedback loop that feeds you more and more of that. And so your access to these stories will become narrower and narrower, and you will get more and more of the same. And so it's a very different upstream cause, but the result ends up being very similar. Back then, there just, to some extent, unless you got a good alternative piece of press, there wasn't enough media. Now there's too much media, but the algorithms mean you don't get much of it. So what are a few of the big stories, and, you know, like headline and one moment to tell us what that is?
Well, there's a number of them, Terrence. And just since you riffed on surveillance capitalism, Shoshana Zuboff's great work. One of the stories is on school-issued technology posing surveillance risk for students. Nolan is doing several major research projects on that very issue right now. Some of the biggest, and Nolan, go ahead, take a second if you want, yeah, just a couple sentences about how this is really a really pernicious, insidious problem in our schools.
Yeah, increasingly everything we do in a classroom is surveilled. If you're a student or faculty, there's being a record kept of it. There's outside entities collecting data on it, and it's being shared. And I regret to report that largely a lot of it is legal. There are loopholes in laws like FERPA, which allow schools to share data with so-called educational partners. And a lot of these corporations are educational partners, like Canvas's learning management system, or whoever holds your school email, or if you use things like Glean or Bark or Dojo. But inside those companies, equity firms, which profit from analyzing data, they also hold the major stakeholder share in those companies. So they become educational partners. And what I've been able to document with our great friend and colleague, Allison Butler from University of Massachusetts Amherst, is that they're using this data to basically follow people from cradle to the grave. And that's not being hyperbolic. There's programs like Baby Connect, where you can follow everything about your baby, its biometrics, its sleeping patterns, its experiences. That can then, you know, be triangulated 15 years later with their high school data and college data to give some what they call psychographic profile of who this individual is, so we can make determinations about how to nudge their behavior or predict their behavior if we're an insurance company, a political campaign, et cetera. So this is a part of a longer war where corporations have tried to get into schools, because you have an audience that's required to be there and it's quite representative of the population. And they sell this to otherwise well-meaning administrators who say, like, oh, this solves discipline, this solves safety, this prevents school shootings, this helps student retention, all these great things. But, you know, they ignore that there's some serious exploitative properties, especially to vulnerable communities like communities of color, people with, you know, contested documentation status or immigration status, victims of stalking, you know, and things like that. So it's something we've looked at, and to see it in the top list of project-centered stories, it makes sense to me. And it's another example of why folks need to, you know, follow project-centered. Otherwise, you're just simply not getting this news.
A couple of quick points. One that you didn't mention is another reason that those equity companies love this is that advertisers know that once you have a customer, you may have them for life. I mean, so if you can aim your algorithm at children, and scratch the data of children, there's probably nothing more valuable than to grab them at that age and begin to groom them as the kind of consumer you want. One other thing I want to mention, just if people find that notion of what's going on in classrooms appalling, and I'm just throwing this out because it's just one of the crazier things about surveillance capitalism. If a smart TV is markedly cheaper than another smart TV, think Vizio, the reason is that they're not making their money from the TV you bought. They're making their money from the data that smart TV is telling other people about you, because it's watching you and listening to you all day long. I mean, crazy stuff.
Great point. If it has the word smart in it, that means it's exploiting you and means you're not being smart by purchasing it.
Very good. Couple of other stories.
Go ahead. No, well, I mean, look, there's a couple connections. So we like to do this in the top 25. By the way, you can see all these stories for free online. The stories are online at projectcensored.org. So we encourage listeners and viewers to go check that out. The top story this last year was fossil fuel industry is subsidized at the rate of $11 million per minute. $11 million per minute, right? Let's think about what that means. Let's think about where that money's coming from and what it does. Let's think about the environmental connections and catastrophe. Let's connect that with story number four, Terrence. At least 128 members of Congress are invested in the fossil fuel industry. So the very same Congress that's behind the investment, some of the subsidization are involved in this directly. Of course, that transfers over into advertising money, et cetera. I mean, you can't really make this up. The Gates Foundation gave $319 million to news outlets all across the world. So that raises serious questions about their independence and their coverage of anything from the COVID pandemic policies to technology and surveillance capitalism, right? If Bill Gates is financing news companies all over the world, how are they reporting about what he's up to or big tech? The CIA discussed plans to kidnap and kill Julian Assange. So, I mean, there's no way Assange could possibly get a fair trial in a place like the United States if he were extradited here under the Espionage Act. But whenever we hear about that case, if we even do anymore, no one wants to bring up the fact that the U.S. has been trying to eliminate him for years. And that's an important part of context.
Remind people what his offense
Assange was. One of the founders of WikiLeaks. And, you know, this is what you started this conversation with on the Iraq war and the lies of Bush and Cheney. Well, part of WikiLeaks got off the ground when Chelsea Manning, then Bradley Manning, leaked cables to Assange at WikiLeaks. And we found the collateral murder video. We saw the U.S. committing massive war crimes. We saw lie after lie after lie being exposed. And what did the U.S. government do? What we always do, what they always do, shoot the messenger. They went after Assange and they tried to get him any way they could. And they finally basically got him through a series of various procedures. He was actually living in the Ecuadorian embassy in England for a long, long time, and they were spying on him there. They were illegally spying on his conversations with attorneys. He now still sits in the Belmarsh prison. And at the Censored Press, we just published probably one of the best books on the topic by Kevin Gastola. It's called Guilty of Journalism. It's the case against Julian, the political case against Julian Assange. It pretends for press freedom. Yeah. It's not just about Assange, the person, or WikiLeaks. It's what does this mean for press freedom worldwide? And that's the big issue.
I mean, in a sense, it kind of echoes Daniel Ellsberg's revelations in the Pentagon Papers. And it was, he was willing to go to jail for life. It turned out through Nixon administration mishaps and messing their prosecution up, he did not. Assange, though, as your book says, his fate and future still hang in the balance.
Yes. Very much so. And I think that people don't have a real objective view, not only of what Assange and WikiLeaks were about, but how significant sources are for journalists and what the misapplication of the Espionage Act against the publisher can actually do to shut down the free flow of information and narratives that challenge the status quo.
And if I can jump in here for a second, I think it speaks to somewhere where we started. We were talking about a little earlier about the relevance of Project Censored in this day and age. I think I usually don't speak for Mickey, but I will in this case. I think both Mickey and I wish Project Censored was irrelevant in 2023, but it's not. If you go back, and especially, you know, we're both historians, but if you look at like the early 1990s, listeners and viewers will remember there was this great talk about the information superhighway, and we were going to have endless and boundless access to everything that was out there, and it was going to connect the world. I hate to report that really didn't happen. A handful of corporations, which economists call the FANGs, this is Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, they control the majority of traffic online. And they've been pressured to practice more and more moderation for a litany of purposes, a lot of them conflicts of interest with the military-industrial complex and the political class. But the result is when you search for something online, you don't have boundless access to any information. You have whatever information they allow you to see. And increasingly, especially since 2017, 2018, they've changed their algorithms to only give you legacy media sources. So all this talk about how we're moving into a digital environment and we have access to new information, really, we've just digitized the same problem we had in the pre-digital environment, unless, to your point, Terrence, you know where to go, like unless you know these other outlets exist. And I think this is critical in the case of Assange. Most people, I think, would believe that Assange is the guy and who tanked Hillary Clinton's campaign, and that's why people are coming after him. I mean, that's how he's seen in so many circles, which is totally false and inaccurate. But the real story of Assange and what happened here and its implications for press freedom, you've got to go to somewhere like Project Censored to get that. You'll never get that on MSNBC, even if they mention Assange.
Okay, let me throw to both of you. And if you want to pick it up first, since we're going to lose you soon, Nolan, go ahead. Oh, let me first tell people that this is a free forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Mickey Huff, the bearded one, director of Project Censored, and Nolan Higdon. And they are, we're talking, we're shifting sort of right here from the Project Censored and the book, State of the Free Press 2023, to the book Let's Agree to Disagree, A Critical Thinking Guide to Communication, Conflict Management, and Critical Media Literacy, a long, wonky title. But basically their sort of three-pronged way of looking at the dialogue that is missing and the information that is missing, which is keeping us from having a full democracy. And you can learn more at projectcensored, all one word, .org. Again, before we lose you, Nolan, I hear more about the dark web, QAnon, the ugly, nefarious stuff that's out there than I do about the lack of what's out there, right? I mean, as someone who obviously looks at alternative sources and all of that, still there's a nightmarish aspect to some extent about, you know, what's going on. In how do you guys plot that line between absolute false, dangerous, if you will, information and censorship and all of that? You know where I'm going. Nolan first, since I know we're going to lose you in a bit.
Yeah, I think, the genesis for this book kind of helps explain that answer. Mickey and I have both worked, as you pointed out, for years, publishing on this work and teaching people how to spot disinformation. And we've talked about the problems of disinformation, et cetera. And on our last couple of book tours, you know, Mickey and I, whether we were together or not, we would always share notes afterward. Inevitably, a handful of people would say, like, hey, that's really great. Thank you so much for showing us how to spot disinformation. But you know, what do I do to talk to someone who believes disinformation? And we were getting this question like over and over again, to the point where Mickey and I said, you know, we may want to write something on this. Like, this seems to be a problem we keep getting asked about. And at the same time, Mickey and I were pretty horrified to read these news articles that said Americans believe a civil war is going to happen in their lifetime, and their number one enemy, or sorry, their number one fear is other Americans. And as historians, we were like, this, you can't have a democracy when you fear each other. You can disagree and vote against each other, and that stuff's all fine. But when you actually fear each other, like you being elected will destroy my way of life. It prevents any sort of social capital to develop to promote any democracy. And so we made this text to do the three things. I know it's a wonky title, but one is, we need to learn to talk to each other constructively. We can't cancel each other or censor each other or pretend we don't exist, even if we find the information dangerous. We also need to hone our critical thinking skills. And so we need to have a dedication to truth and veracity of information versus political party. And part of that is rooted in where the third part of the subtitle, which is critical media literacy. Media are our storytellers. They do shape our interpretation of the world. As a teacher, I know this all the time. When I give an example of something, a student will raise their hand and be like, oh, is that kind of like that movie? Because the movie has helped them understand this part of the world. Or when we hear a particular news story about somewhere else, like George Floyd's murder, millions of people turned out in outrage about what happened to George Floyd. They never met him, never been to his community. But thanks to media, they had some indication of what had happened there. So the media are hugely powerful, but we don't take it seriously in our schools. We don't teach people how to sift through media. We don't take media. It's seen as wasting time in class if you put a film on. Where we know as media scholars, look, this stuff has a huge impact. We have to equip people with the skills to understand what that impact is and use it responsibly. Because when they're in dialogue, and destructive dialogue in particular, they're usually talking about a caricature of the other side that they've heard from news media. So we need to help them understand why that caricature is developed, how it works against our democracy, and how to take a much more constructive and critical thinking approach to dialogue versus this kind of mediated disinformation, which dictates so much of our dialogue right now.
Okay, yeah. Let me jump in with one point here. So just building on what you just said, Nolan, one of the culprits in your perspective is the mainstream media, who you say turned from framing things as the U.S. versus communism, China, Russia, to the U.S. versus itself, right? Now, and I think you, because I remember reading that and I went, well, but they're skipping that area where it was versus terrorism. That was sort of, let's not forget that was, that had its run. That had its
yes,
run.
Yes, it did.
But the
one that is very true. But that also happened in the middle of us versus us. Like the 1990s are really the pivotal point because the culture ends and it's us. They did try terrorism to unite us for a couple of years, but it went, of course, right back to us versus us.
That's where I was going to go, is that that was sort of a transition phase. But of course, the one that is more reliable and more sustainable as a corrupting influence in favor of the media is us against us, that everything is a competition. And let me throw one thing out to you, which is that I was reminded of, do either of you know the book What Really Happened in the 1960s, How Mass Media Culture Failed Democracy? No? Hmm. Oh, you would love it. Edward P. Morgan, the author. And he looks at the 60s and says the media caricatured and distorted a genuine moment of democratic examination and a call for systemic progressive reform as a moment of generational misbehavior.
Yes.
The whole notion of the generation gap. Oh, we just lost Nolan.
Nolan had to go, yeah, but that's okay. But I am so glad that you brought that up, Terrence. That is a precursor.
That's
to what it's. This is the thing, and this is as historians as well. Nolan and I point this out over and over again that we've had so many signposts, we've had so many really brilliant analysts and scholars and journalists and artists, and writers and poets that have all along the way showed us and told us and warned us. Not to go back too far, but we've got to start somewhere. If you go back even and look at H.L. Mencken in the 20s or Walter Lippmann, and then take a look at, of course, Eddie Bernays, who was on the other side of saying we should be manipulating people's behavior. They can't be trusted. That was 1928. Well, of course, out of World War One, and then Bernays wrote in 1928 the book Propaganda about the conscious manipulation of the masses, right? He was saying that was a good idea. And that manufacturing consent later spawned Chomsky and Herman's criticism of that kind of propaganda model, right? But we had so many other people along the way. Upton Sinclair, The Brass Check, right? Very important book. A.J. Liebling, The Wayward Press, right? Right. The freedom of the press belongs only to those who own one, 1961. Historian Daniel Boorstin, The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America, right around the time that Morgan was writing on media distortion, right, of the generation of the 60s. So we are really building, I think, we're standing on the shoulders of these people. And we're simply trying to show that there's enough historical evidence that this is an issue that we should have gotten serious about it in our schools and in our education a long time ago. But as Ralph Nader always has pointed out, and he wrote the foreword to one of our books, there is such regulatory capture in government that we cannot rely on our civic institutions to educate our way out of these problems. We're rather normalized into them. As we started earlier with Nolan saying, why didn't I hear this somewhere else?
Right.
Why would we just taught this history? It's by design.
Let me just say for one very quick thing about regulatory capture.
Yeah.
Which is that I think that the time that it became clearest to me, you know, how that works, is when we were dealing with how to deal with landfills. And what you found was that Waste Management and Browning Ferris, the big players, fought regulation until it was inevitable. And once it became inevitable, then they wrote it.
That's right.
And they wrote it in a way that only the biggest players could meet those regulations. And I think if people can just think about that, you can apply it at case after case after case.
Norfolk Southern, East Palestine train derailment.
What? Oh, exactly.
East Palestine train.
Will fight regulation, and then they will buy the enough of the politicians that they can actually write the regulation so that it suits them.
Lobbying and dark money. Some of the top censored stories every year are about how we don't even know. The public doesn't even know where this money's coming from. I mean, we know it's coming from nefarious, conflicted sources that are trying to manipulate public policy, but it's no longer in the public interest, if it ever even was, but it becomes less and less and less so, right? And of course, as you know, in the early 70s, the Lewis Powell memo to the Chamber of Commerce decried what was happening, the democratic civil rights movements of the 60s. And Lewis Powell, who later ended up on the Supreme Court, Nixon appointed him, warned that if the right wing doesn't organize and control, either create its own institutions or curtail public ones or both, as Grover Norquist said, he wanted to shrink government down to the size where it could be drowned in a bathtub, right? That's all out of the Nixon era. Somehow we can't seem to escape our conversation of the Nixon era. By the way, Carl Jensen from Project Censored also called out that the Nixon White House actively suppressed and censored Walter Cronkite's coverage of Watergate. So, I mean, so much comes out of the 60s and 70s, which is why I'm really glad you brought up Morgan. That's going on the reading list immediately.
Yeah. So the point I was making was that he pointed out that the way that the mass of Americans then and certainly since have viewed that era as Morgan puts it, I think, as generational brattiness, not to be concerned with. Doesn't really, you know, it's just an eruption. It's just a tantrum. Yeah. There's nothing real going on here. And then, as you say, nowadays, framing the issues as conflict and polarization on every issue. And I think if you could have gone back 20 years and they could have predicted these competing cable news networks and that sort of thing, it would have been like, you mean it'll get that good for us? You know, we'll be able to polarize people so much that's the way they see through. That's the perspective through which they see everything.
Well, 87, no more fairness doctrine under Reagan. So no more equal time. 96, Clinton, Gingrich, the second major mass telecom act that deregulated media for media ownership. Same year that Reagan operative Roger Ailes founded Fox News. No mistakes, no accidents, no happenstance.
And I bet we could look at Clear Channel and Rush Limbaugh.
Keep going. Exactly. Same deal. That came right after the Fairness Doctrine went
away.
Absolutely. And they took over AM radio because a lot of coastal elites and liberals thought AM radio was dead. Yeah. It wasn't
and,
doing
and
anything.
One thing that's funny is you will see people often saying, how is it in the Republicans' party's interest to do this? Or how is it in the Democratic Party's interest to do this? When in fact, the interest who it absolutely serves is the media's.
Absolutely.
And their sponsors.
They're part of the power elite, right? As C. Wright Mills would say, yeah. And Peter Phillips went on to write about in Giants, what those groups look like today.
And it's sort of a funny coincidence, not a coincidence, but a funny thing that the media that is selling you polarization is sponsored by pharmaceuticals, one of the great elite corrupt institutions in America. But that's just sidelight.
Can you say the Sackler family? Yeah. I mean, perfect example. And the Sacklers go back to the 20s when they merged pharma with advertising. That's another fantastic story.
It is. It is. Absolutely. I want you to talk about a couple of your terms, which is censorship by proxy and algorithmic censorship, just so people get a sense of how you look at censorship.
Well, censorship at Project Censored, we've always thought censorship isn't just the traditional sense where the government comes and blacks out a story. We know that happens because we know leaks and other things and whistleblowers that important. They tell us these important things, whether it's Dan Ellsberg, Edward Snowden, fill in the blanks, right? But the more pernicious, insidious, pervasive, and ubiquitous kind of censorship is more corporate censorship or censorship by proxy. So Project Censored has long talked about censorship as anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have free press principles. And if you go back and look at Article 19 in the UN Charter, the UN Declaration of Rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it talks about the right not only to impart information, but the right to receive it, the right to hear it, to see it, to have access to it. So when we have major corporations, six controlling 90% of the media and five big tech companies algorithmically catering to people's confirmation bias and framing information outside of it, we see if you look at that definition of censorship, that's happening all over the place. And even the peek behind the curtain we get to see with the Twitter files, with all the problems of Taibbi and Musk aside. But what we see is the government is involved in trying to sort of put its thumb on the scales. And under the guise of fighting fake news, these big tech companies and government have used this as a Trojan horse wedge issue to police disinformation or misinformation online based on what their definitions of the truth is in a so-called post-truth world, which means post-truth, right, is the postmodern problem that, well, if it fits the status quo and if it matches my confirmation bias fueled by my implicit biases, this is what we're going to say the truth is. We've moved very far away from objective reality, very far away from these so-called fact-checking organizations, Terrence. They're like NATO. They're like the PR firm for NATO. Atlantic Council is a fact checker for Facebook. NATO itself is partnering with media literacy organizations to create NATO's own media literacy campaigns. And guess what they are? They're Western propaganda campaigns masquerading as information literacy programs. So we have real Trojan horse. We have real sort of wolf in sheep's clothing characters and actors now operating to allegedly be arbiters in the fake news debate. And what we need to do is to fight this. The antidote to this is to get people thinking critically and independently. It's not to censor things that are unpopular. It's to teach people how to think about them in the first place.
Well, if you had the power to play things out the way you wish, you're clearly against censorship and for discussion. But till we achieve, quote, discussion, which means critical thinking, ability to debate and so on, are we safe or is democracy safe with just wide dissemination and even devotion to lies? In other words, if the big lie leads to January 6th and voter suppression, and maybe in 2024, actually false electors, depending on what happens in certain states, right? If anti-Semitic lies lead to mass killings, what do you recommend we do? Because if we just removed, you know where I'm going. If you just say, oh, you can't stop fake news, you can't stop Alex Jones, you can't stop QAnon, you can't stop the dark web. But we're not at that state where the public seems to be able to deal with that.
So, and I want to address that because it's a very important point. So we already have laws on the books that don't permit incitement. We already have laws that don't allow people to libel or slander others. It's how those are used or misused or applied or not applied that's a big part of this problem as well. Now, the other problem we already brought up when we talked about the Telecom Act, and that is that a lot of these laws or rules with FCC don't seem to apply to cable or don't seem to apply to other outlets. And so those, and especially what we call anti-social media platforms, right? But these social media platforms, they're not subject to the same rules. And they say, hey, we're just putting stuff out there. We're not publishing it. So we're not responsible. And then so they pass the buck, right? And that's Section 230. And so the issue then is you really hit the nail on the head. I mean, squarely, we have some speech that is dangerous. But what we have to do is we really have to measure it. When we see this kind of speech, when we see absolute falsehoods, we need to have our institutions and major media outlets call that out, not on a partisan basis, but on a factual basis, on a critical basis, on a basis where these institutions should be modeling discourse, modeling debate. And instead, when they do model it, they have right versus left, red versus blue. I'm right, you're wrong, no matter what. Who can say the most incendiary thing to even get us away from the topic we're talking about, to keep getting eyeballs to the screen to get advertiser money? Therein lies a big part of the problem. Schools increasingly have moved away from controversial subjects because parents get upset, funding gets on the line, and teachers who are already overworked and underpaid say, my goodness, am I really going to introduce a controversial subject and risk my job?
And one thing there is that the cultivated polarization,
yes,
it's an environment in which schools, teachers, organizations, I'm guessing ministers, you name it,
yes,
shy away because so it feeds itself.
Yes. And so that's the feedback loop we're in. And again, there's no perfect fix. And there's so many things that have contributed to this conundrum, if you were, this real existential crisis for democracy. You know, we've been in a period of civil decay or civic decay for half a century plus. And we've marked it in many of our publications, and we've marked how the media, the establishment press, has been marching in neoliberal lockstep fashion into a society that is not equitable, into a society that does not believe or practice sustainable environmentalism. We've been brought here, as Lao Tzu quipped ages and ages ago. I got to get it out here because it's too good of a quote. If you do not change direction, you may end up where you're heading. Are we there yet? The way that we reverse course or change course is through education, is by rebuilding trust in our institutions. That's another one of the problems, Terrence. We have record low public opinion levels of our major institutions, of Congress, of government, of media.
Of each other.
Of each other.
Democracy, society itself, whether you call it democracy or not, depends on trust. Why are the Scandinavian countries happiest when, in fact, they have all that bad weather? One of the reasons is that their trust is much greater with each other than America's.
You know, now, Terrence, what we try to do in Let's Agree to Disagree is not pretend that all speech is fine, right? We don't pretend that people should be doormats. We don't pretend that people should be victims of violent rhetoric. But we do say people should learn how to be responsible critical thinkers, be aware of their cognitive biases. We need to learn how to use dialogue and critical thinking to build bridges, not walls.
Right. So one of the things I was thinking was, given where this was sort of your argument was sort of unfolding, I often think that the press practices false objectivity, false,
yes,
equivalence.
Yes.
And I thought you might be against them pointing out, no, that's, you know, this, but you're not. You're saying that as long as what you're dealing with is not partisan label versus partisan label, but truth versus falsehood, you're okay with that. If the media and the press points out this is the facts,
yeah,
but how do you decide what facts to trust?
Well, that's very interesting. And that goes back to the core of critical independent thinking itself. We can't get away from tenets of critical pedagogy here. We have to understand there is a way that we can think more critically and independently. There are true and tested means by which we can test evidence. We're just not teaching it to everybody in our schools. And by the time I'm teaching it at a community college in Northern California, and people like Nolan stumble into my class by accident and have to say, why have I been missing this?
Right.
That is a failure of our institutions to meet the very basic needs we need to be self-governing. This is where we need to begin addressing the problem, which is why we wrote The Media and Me, critical media literacy guide for young people.
Right.
We're not starting with young people, and that's where we need to start.
Okay, so let me ask you, we sort of got an idea now of where what you think has to happen. Is it happening? Where is there good news? Where is something working? And if so, why is it working?
We've got a lot of great critical media literacy organizations around the country and around the world that we're partnering with. We are getting our curriculum out to as many places as we can. We've had some grants that have enabled us to get our books, our curriculum out to schools and teachers for free. And we think that, look, it took us a long time to get where we are now, and we're not going to snap our fingers in the instant gratification culture and get out of it. But we've got to start somewhere.
By the way, when you say it's taken us a long time to get where, you don't mean to get where Project Censored is. You mean to get with the problem we face.
Yeah. The problem we face is collective.
Perhaps ever, but certainly, as you say, at least 50, 60, 70 years.
It shouldn't matter if we're Democrats or Republicans or liberals or conservatives. It shouldn't matter what our race is or our creed. These things are parts of our who we are as a society. But if we are going to be self-governing, if we really believe that transparent self-governance is the fairest or most equitable kind of society we can have based in our constitutional structures, we've got to have critically thinking citizens. We've got to have media literate citizens, and we've got to have space for disagreement. But it's important that we teach people not just how to think critically, but how to communicate both critically and compassionately. You could have the smartest, most well-supported opinion or perspective on a controversial issue in the entire world, but if you do not think clearly about how you communicate it to a particular audience, it will fall flat. No one will hear it.
If I give you at this point a minute and a half to answer the question you said you and Nolan kept getting on your book tours, which is, how do I talk to people whose ideas I don't like and what they may mean and what they may say, whose ideas I know are full of crap?
Well, I think that there needs to be a process for finding out whether or not people's ideas are full of crap. And as a matter of communication, if you start by saying somebody is basically full of it, you're already starting off on a negative bias for the frame of the interaction. And so Daniel Dennett and other philosophers and other counselors and many people over the years they've come up with other ways that we can communicate with people. Active listening is a really, really big one. Showing people that you not only are listening to what they're saying, but you're trying to understand it by repeating back to them what they're saying. Yeah. Even if you disagree with it, that's later. The first thing is, are you really listening to somebody in a way that you want to understand? Because if somebody can see that you're really interested in understanding, that sets a different tone than I'm right, you're wrong, no matter what. I'm just waiting for my turn to talk. Right. And we live in a culture where we talk past each other, over each other, at each other. We don't practice talking with each other.
Let me just say one thing. I have in another part of my life done a lot of communications consulting to organizations and so on. And I always say that the most important slide in my deck is the one that says, more than anything, human beings want to feel seen and heard.
Absolutely.
And if you can make people around you feel seen and heard with your children, with your spouse, with your coworkers, and with those you disagree with, your life will be different.
It will. And we have in the Let's Agree to Disagree book, the last chapter is Let's Get Critical. We use the word critical to have, you know, steps of these are things that you can do to be a more independent critical thinker, a clearer and better, more empathetic communicator and active listener. And you may even be able to understand and navigate media the degree to which that you can use it to fashion better, more rational, logical arguments and presentations yourself. And so these are all things that go together. And at the end of the book, we talk about how you need to stay engaged. We need to learn how to experience discomfort. We need to make space, take space. We need to speak our truths and listen to other truths. We need to talk in first person and not mischaracterize others. We need to expect and accept non-closure. We may not solve everything in this conversation, Terrence, but if we respect each other enough to keep the conversation going, I'm going to continue to benefit and learn, and maybe I'll get a chance to teach somebody something that they didn't even know they were ready to learn yet or that they wanted to learn yet. We need to maintain respect and confidentiality with people, listen with the intent to learn, not rebut, and we should suspend judgment until the process is reaching a completion, which may be maybe sometime. We shouldn't necessarily just knee-jerk somebody the first time we meet them. We should wait. We should be patient. We should give people a chance. I know first impressions often speak volumes, but we also, Terrence, all make mistakes. And we're also very emotional creatures. And sometimes we really let that part of us get the better of us when we're passionate. And we may end up coming across to people in ways that prevent them from listening or understanding to us. And so, and again, that's not to say that,
you got to be mealy mouthed or
no. So Let's Agree to Disagree doesn't mean that you have to be conciliatory. In fact, you may disagree emphatically. It's fine to be to have this disagreement. What Nolan and I argue is that we should try to be less disagreeable, right? The way in which we disagree can set the stage for learning, growth, and guess what? Change.
Yes.
Because at the end of the day, we all have similar values. We just have value conflicts about certain issues, right? But if we can build the bridges of trust with the values we share, we might be able to expand people's consciousness and awareness about why we have some disagreements and where we can find ways to work together on controversial matters that affect so many of us.
Right. Okay. As I often say, the critical challenges we face, and we do, really call for this approach, even though it may take time. Again, the new book is Let's Agree to Disagree, A Critical Thinking Guide to Communication, Conflict Management, and Critical Media Literacy. And you can learn more at projectcensored.org. Thank you. Well, thank you to Nolan Higdon, and thank you to Mickey Huff. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence. It was a real honor to be here with you today. Really appreciate what you do. And again, we really appreciate the chance to get to have such a great conversation and dialogue. And we hope this is a model for other people to have dialogue about these kinds of issues.
Now let me tell people, for this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to about 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, or you can sign up at my site. And actually, you can sign up for the podcast at most of the podcast sites. But to get my email announcement, you got to either reach out to me or do it at my site. And when you go to the podcast, archives include Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer, you name it. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams and Federico Garcia in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much, Terrence.